Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the tyranny of the minority in the US Senate, who yesterday acted on behalf of a vocal minority, the NRA, that represents 1% of the population, thwarting the will of 90% of Americans. Joining us is Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic, where he has an article, Did Our Founders Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control, the Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate. Then we'll look into the massive deadly explosion in Texas at a fertilizer plant that was last inspected by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration 28 years ago in 1985, when they found five serious violations and fined West Fertilizer $30. Keith Wrightson, the worker safety and health advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division, joins us to discuss the understaffed OSHA, whose measly budget of $558 million oversees the workplace deaths of 4,500 Americans per year, while hundreds of billions more is spent combating terrorists who since 9/11 have killed 238 Americans, an average of 24 per year. Then finally, we'll examine the new report, the Task Force on Detainee Treatment, by the Bipartisan Constitutional Project, that calls upon the nation to avoid the mistake of seeking revenge through human rights violations, as was done after 9/11. Mark Danner, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New Yorker Review of Books, and the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror, joins us. And joining us now is Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, Did Our Founders Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alec McGillis.
Thanks for having me.
And at this point, the pictures that we spent most of yesterday waiting for from the FBI briefing that didn't happen have been posted of the two suspects that may be associated with the bombing in Boston. You also wrote the other day at the New Republic about the irony that Homeland Security's, where it does its explosive investigations, is there at Northeastern University and was closed on the very day. My understanding, just before we get into the gun control issue, because it is actually associated with the NRA,
right,
is that the NRA were the ones that stopped the ATF efforts to put what they call taggants in explosives, which are markers which help in forensic investigations of explosions. Just as they've thwarted gun control, apparently they've also thwarted efforts to track those who use explosives.
No, I saw that same report. You're right. There's a long-running battle between the NRA and the ATF. We don't have a director, a confirmed director of the ATF. Haven't had one for some time, largely because of opposition that the NRA has to the entire organization and its mission.
Which, at this point, it would be real helpful, would it not, to know, although it looks as though maybe these were improvised explosives. They certainly were improvised explosive devices.
Right.
But the idea that any domestic terrorism involving explosives found in the United States or purchased or stolen in the United States cannot be traced because of the NRA is pretty egregious under the present circumstances.
It's pretty remarkable. It's not, although I guess some would say that it's not necessarily all that much more remarkable than the troubles they've posed for tracing, guns used in major gun crimes. So,
which, of course, is the Tyhart Amendment that forbids the ATF and any law enforcement agency sharing information about gun crimes,
right,
weapons that have already killed and maimed people found at crime scenes. So let's talk about what you've been writing about, though, and the day that the president said was a shameful day in Washington when the efforts, these modest, watered-down efforts at gun control involving improving background checks on weapons purchases didn't even get debated because of the filibuster threshold of 60. Is that, before we get into your arguments about the tyranny of small states in the undemocratic Senate, that's in itself an extraordinary usurpation of power, is it not? The use of the...
The filibuster, no yeah. Question. I mean, I think that's really where this discussion has to start, is with the filibuster and the fact that it's that it's now just completely accepted and completely routine that you need those 60 votes, a supermajority. They had their 54 votes yesterday, and that's a majority, and that was not enough. There was an attempt, you know, just a few months ago, to try to weaken the filibuster, and it was even that attempt. There was a pretty incremental reform, but that was let drop. Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, did not push it as hard as he might have, and there was, of course, great resistance from Mitch McConnell on the other side. So there was that chance, that window, to try to do something about this filibuster, and they missed that. So now, once again, we have something that had 54 votes, a majority of senators, and it does not go anywhere.
So in terms of the votes themselves, the 54, there were four Democrats who voted with the Republicans who almost unanimously voted against it. Those four being Mark Begich from Alaska, Arkansas's Mark Pryor, Max Baucus of Montana, and Heidi Heinkamp of North Dakota. Interesting enough, four Republicans voted for it. So right. I guess they level each other out. Let's talk about the idea that Heidi Heinkamp comes from a state that has a population of 700,000, which is smaller than cities like Columbus, Fort Worth, and Charlotte, yet is able to have such critical influence over this gun debate, where they may be free in small states to wield weapons, but most of the victims of weapons are in urban areas, and they tend to have the red states have a disproportionate political power than those that are essentially the victims of gun violence. Is that how it's working out in America?
Oh, completely. I mean, there's no other issue probably where the sort of hegemony of the small states in the Senate, in small rural states, comes to bear as much as with gun control. I mean, it is simply extraordinary, and it cannot be stated enough that it's extraordinary that North Dakota has two votes in the Senate, has 700,000 people. It's as large, as you said, as what we think of as mid-sized cities like Columbus and Fort Worth. It's smaller than your average congressional district, and it has two senators, which is as many as, of course, as California does, with vastly, vastly more people. It's just remarkable, and it's an issue like guns where this really comes through. That said, I do think we should add that we should not let these senators sort of off the hook on this vote simply because they come from small rural states and face a sort of a different culture back home. The fact is that some senators, some Democrats from red-leaning rural states did vote for the gun law yesterday, including some people right next door to Heidi Heitkamp. Tim Johnson from South Dakota, he voted for it. John Tester from Montana, he voted for it. But Max Baucus and Heidi Heitkamp did not. So these were decisions that each of these people made, and we should always keep that in mind and not just sort of allow them to sort of ascribe it to their geographic happenstance.
So this disparity where you have 38 million people who live in the 22 smallest states represented by 44 senators, comparing it here to the state of California where you have 38 million Californians represented by two, this, of course, is in the very foundation of the country, and it's often brought up in terms of the Electoral College. But my understanding is at this point, there have been a lot of efforts on the part of Democrats to suggest the Electoral College should be reformed because it went against them in Florida in 2000. But it looks as if the Electoral College actually went against the Republicans in the last election.
It probably did in the last election. I think we shouldn't be, should be careful not to muddy the debate between the Electoral College and the Senate, because if you step back and look at it, the Electoral College has its own inequities and own problems, which is that someone can, as happened to Al Gore, of course, you can win a majority of the popular vote and lose the Electoral College. But the fact is that the Electoral College is still vastly more rational, really, than the Senate, in the sense that South Dakota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming have way, 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 way fewer Electoral College votes than does California or New York or Texas. Yet they have, in the Senate, they have the exact same say. And that is just so extraordinary. And it's something that simply could not, I don't think that the founders, we should hold the founders to account for having come up with this deal that they had. At the same time, we have to realize that they surely had no idea what what it was setting up for themselves. The fact is, at the time of the Constitutional Convention, when they came up with this compromise for how to set up the Congress, the largest state of the original 13, Virginia, at the time, was about 11 or 12 times larger than the smallest one, which was Delaware. So they said, okay, we're going to give everyone two seats in the Senate. We'll have the House be done by population, but the Senate will everyone get two. We now have a situation where the largest state, California, is 66 times larger than the smallest one, Wyoming. So you have these disparities that have just grown vastly larger. In some sense, the responsibility maybe falls to the Congresses of the 19th century as we were growing across the country. And when they decided to basically divvy up these vast open spaces into multiple states, none of which have grown, many of which have not grown all that much since. And so you have two Dakotas, for instance. Dakota Territory got broken into two different states. So the Dakotas, you know, which together just have, you know, about as many people as, you know, say Philadelphia, are now two states with four senators, twice the say as California. It's really pretty remarkable.
Again, I'm speaking with Alec MacGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. And previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, "Did Our Founding Fathers' Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate." So turning back to the undemocratic Senate and yesterday's shameful day in Washington, as the president said, but it wasn't so long ago, was it, Alec, that senators were appointed by state legislatures, which led to enormous corruption because a lot of these legislatures were owned by the railroad companies, and it was only reformed by, what was it, the 15th or 17th Amendment?
Right. Yes, and it's interesting. You know, I think this is there are two. The Senate, as originally conceived, was undemocratic in two ways. And there was the fact that it was apportioned two per state, not by population. And there was the fact that it was set up; it was not directly elected by the people. And that the latter problem was fixed. The thing is, I think these two things are often conflated, in the sense that people, when I bring up this point about the Senate's apportionment being just crazily undemocratic, you have a lot of people say to you, "Ah, but James Madison wanted it this way. This was this whole idea of us being a republic, not a mass mob democracy. You needed to have the Senate to be a little bit removed from the mass of the people." And that's true. Madison wanted the Senate to be sort of a level higher than the House, away from the masses, but he did not want the Senate to be apportioned two per state. He thought that was wrong. He thought that they should be apportioned by population. Madison was in favor of the non-direct election of the Senate. That was part of his whole notion. He was not in favor of having it divvied up the way it was. He was from Virginia, a big state, and he thought it was only proper that Virginia should have more of a say in the Senate than Delaware or Rhode Island. And it was only because of the horse trading that had to happen at the Constitutional Convention that we came up with the so-called Connecticut Compromise, which was that the House would be apportioned by population, but the Senate would not.
So you're not in any way they're letting off the White House on this, are you, Alec? Because I think there is some criticism that's due to their tactics. They seem to have waited too long after Newtown. They had a commission that made recommendations that, you know, you could have – we already knew everything that they were saying. I don't know why they needed a commission, why they didn't act sooner, why they loaded this thing up with the assault weapons ban, which then gave the NRA the huge opening to say they're going to take away our guns. If they would have started out with a more modest approach, they would have ended up with something as opposed to nothing.
Well, you can definitely do some armchair quarterbacking. I think there's a case to be made that they did wait maybe a little bit too long. Although, you know, the fact is, if they'd really tried to jump on it right away and push something through in the heat of the moment, you might have had some senators saying, you know, using procedure as an excuse not to act, saying, no, look, we're not going to push something like this through. We need to take our time and think about it. You might not have had the development of this quite remarkable alliance between Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey, two senators from very, pro-gun rights states. who were willing to come together around the background check thing. Yes, there are definitely things the White House could have done differently and better. Still, I think at the end of the day, we should not lose sight of who was responsible for this failing yesterday, which is senators. Senators who, both conservative red state Democrats and Republicans, who you might have expected to cross over and support this, but decided not to. And this is a decision that they faced. Some of their colleagues decided that they would take the chance. They would take the chance to face down the NRA and vote for this relatively, you know, measured and incremental reform. But a whole bunch of them decided that they were not up to that. And that's really where I think at the end of the day that the accountability needs to lie.
But how much of it is a case, Alec MacGillis, of the squeaky wheels gets the oil, in as much as why were those senators intimidated by the NRA, who in the last election cycle spent $25 million and had about the worst results of all lobbying groups? And obviously the senators, I think, don't want to rile up the gun fanatics in this country who are very active. So it raises the question of the disparity between the passion of the pro-gun people and the transient nature of the outrage that the gun control people feel following these repetitive massacres that take place in this country.
Right. No, there's definitely there's this old, we much discussed, intensity gap. In the last few weeks, you'd hear so many senators rationalizing their decision by saying, "Well, look, I'm getting a lot of calls from gun rights people in my state urging me to not do this. I'm just getting a lot of calls from them." And you sort of think in response to that, well, of course you are. They're a well-organized lobby. They have their members call. And you can sort of chide the senators for overvaluing the minority of people who are making those calls to them, when in fact polls suggest that, you know, the huge majorities of their voters are just perfectly fine with this legislation. But you could of course also argue that the gun control side, you know, needs to do a better job of just keeping up that kind of basic pressure. But I do think that there's a level in which the some of these congressmen and senators do overestimate the power of this lobby, and I think it's over the years there's this sort of legend that's built up, and I think the media's had a role in it. We've sort of constantly repeat that the Democrats got badly hurt for taking up gun control, that they got hurt in 1994 and 2000, that their losses in those years were ascribed to gun control, when in fact, if you look more closely at them, it's really questionable whether gun control played as large a role in some of those losses as people now think. So we've kind of built up this notion of this all-powerful NRA, and every time, you know, a senator ducks like they did yesterday, it kind of only adds to that legend.
Well, but some of the more strident people in the Senate, not to mention the people that we're talking about, the pro-gun people that lobby their legislators and the NRA encourages and the gun manufacturers finance, you know, you've got people like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Rand Paul, of course, has said the other day that all of these people from Newtown are being used as props. He was very callous, you know, and he's a guy that threatened to filibuster. You got Ted Cruz saying outrageous things. What I find extraordinary in this country, that people on the far right can say incredibly incendiary, irresponsible, dangerous, sometimes completely crackpot things, and they don't get pulled over. I don't understand how our polity has become so poisonous.
Well, that's certainly true. But I got to say, after this week, what I'm finding myself thinking more about are people like people who have shown themselves to be, you know, relatively reasonable on other issues, and people that Democrats can work with, who couldn't bring themselves to vote for this. When you have to think that in their heart of hearts, they saw that it was a completely sensible reform to close these loopholes in the background checks. I'm thinking of people like Rob Portman, the Ohio Republican, Bob Corker and Lamar Alexander in Tennessee, Kelly Ayotte, New Hampshire, this relatively junior senator from New Hampshire. She's a former attorney general from New Hampshire, very, you know, sort of law and order type, good attorney general up there. I covered her when I was in my earlier years reporting up there, and she was, you know, a tough prosecutor, and for her to now decide not to vote to expand the background checks to make sure that felons can't buy guns, you know, I think that's really where the focus needs to lie now, and on people who just decided to duck on this when some of their colleagues in also in tough states had the gumption to vote for it.
Well, just in closing, Alec McGillis, I spoke recently with the political scientist Amitai Etzioni, who makes the argument that there's a different way to look at this, particularly in the Senate, and that is that there are really two parties in the United States, not the Democrats and the Republicans, but the conservatives and the liberals, and that the conservatives simply dominate, and that the liberals are in the minority, and that all of the important legislation that goes against the White House or compromises the White House in the way that the initial stimulus bill was, the health care bill was. If you look at the DNA, and you got people like Max Baucus who voted against the gun control, that's how they always join the Republican majority. So it's these red state Democrats who really are a part of the conservative party as opposed to the Democratic Party.
Right. I mean, you have to be careful not to overgeneralize, because on some issues, of course, you know, such as on you know, say the healthcare law, and maybe some tax issues and fiscal stuff, you'll get the Max Baucus or Heidi Heitkamp on your side. No, but on this one, they really saw their geography as a handy excuse to duck on this, even though some of their colleagues from these same states, you know, thought that they could pull it off. I mean, the fact that Joe Manchin led the way on this legislation. I mean, Joe Manchin's from West Virginia, which is, you know, as got as many, you know, guns per capita as anywhere. And this is a guy who shot a gun at the cap and trade carbon emissions bill a few years ago for a campaign ad to show how tough and in tune with West Virginia he was. And he had the guts to take this on and lead the way on this bill. And he's just standing strong now, and he says he's going to carry on with it, and he's being really quite eloquent in explaining the need for this and calling to account his colleagues who just didn't have what it took to stand up for it.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Alec McGillis.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Alec McGillis, who writes for The New Republic and served as the magazine's chief correspondent for the 2012 campaign. Previously, he spent 5 years at The Washington Post covering politics and domestic policy, and also wrote for The Baltimore Sun. He has an article at The New Republic, "Did Our Founders' Lack of Foresight Doom Gun Control? The Tyranny of Small States in the Undemocratic Senate." We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the massive explosion in Texas.
A man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load the 16 ton. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Keith Wrightson, the worker safety and health advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. He advocates before Congress, state, and federal agencies to improve conditions for workers and for occupational safety and health. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Wrightson.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Keith. And the death toll so far in the blast at the West Fertilizer plant in Waco, Texas, is up to 40 dead and 150 people injured. And what I find extraordinary about the situation there is that the last time that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, inspected that plant, that fertilizer plant in Texas, was 28 years ago in 1985, when they found five serious violations and fined West Fertilizer, guess what, $30. Now, the other disparity, which I want to discuss with you, is that OSHA, which is clearly understaffed, they have a measly budget of $558 million a year, and yet we have workplace deaths of 4,500 Americans per year, and then contrast that with the hundreds of billions more that's spent combating terrorists who, since 9/11, have killed 238 Americans, an average of 24 per year. So let's start with the understaffing and the inspection situation.
So in Texas, this is a historic problem across the United States, particularly in Texas. The state has not been allotted the resources to provide proper oversight for the state's workplaces. Like you just mentioned, OSHA's budget nationally is minuscule in the grand scope of things. What that translates to for Texas is a lack of oversight and a lack of inspections in its workplaces. And just to give you an example of the resources that have been allotted to Texas, under current funding, it would take Texas OSHA inspectors 98 years to inspect each workplace once. It's a horrible number. It's a disregard for occupational safety and health, and it's really placing the public at risk and workers at risk.
So there is, of course, some state inspection as well in Texas. Apparently this plant was inspected by state officials back in 2006 and hasn't been since. And the Environmental Protection Agency fined West Fertilizer $2,300 in 2006 for failing to implement a risk management plan. But as far as I know, the 83-year-old owner is a multimillionaire, isn't he? Isn't this a very lucrative operation he's got? So if he's only getting fined $30 back in 85 for five violations in 2000, and then more recently getting fined $2,300 in 2006, it's not exactly hurting him.
No, it's not hurting him at all. Through some research that we conducted today, the true company name is Adair Grain Incorporated. A lot of the media has been reporting it as the West Fertilizer Company. We found that the company was incorporated started doing business in 1958. So they're a well-established company in the community just north of Waco, Texas. And the fines that you mentioned are disgusting, right? A $30 fine for five violations. I mean, did he just open up his wallet and pay in cash? I'm guessing he probably did. In a lot of these situations, the agency, meaning OSHA, will come in and fine the maximum on an infraction of the OSHA Act. So in 1985, the most significant fine you could get was $1,000 per infraction. Since then, it's been raised to $7,000. But what happens is in the region, the fine gets negotiated down or negotiated away. And that's a real problem for the agency. Nobody should have that ability. And that kind of stuff happens all across the United States, not just in Texas, that's for sure. So you had just mentioned the $2,300 fine that Adair Grain was responsible for in 2006. The EPA levied that fine because they did not have a risk management plan in place. I can't say that plan has anything to do with worker safety, but most likely the environmental controls in case there was a spill or, you know, a release of ammonia gas, because that's what they manufacture there. But still, $2,300, you know, you can bring it right home. That's absolutely nothing for a multimillionaire that had over $4 million in sales last year. So,
well, Keith Wrightson, again, the worker safety and health advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. He advocates before Congress, state and federal agencies to improve conditions for workers and for occupational safety and health. Let's turn to the extraordinary number of Americans that are killed every year in the workplace. That's 4,500. And this is OSHA's budget is $558 million, overseeing the workplace in which 4,500 Americans are killed every year. Contrast that to the billions spent combating terrorism. Again, since 9/11, 238 Americans have died. That's an average of 24 per year. My understanding is the maximum fine for committing a safety violation that leads to a worker's death is $7,000. And then the maximum jail time for willful violation resulting in the death of a worker is 6 months in jail. And since 1970, 360,000 Americans have been killed on the job, but yet there have only been 84 criminal prosecutions.
Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point. There are limitations in the OSHA Act do not provide relief for families or workers, you know, essentially that have been killed. It's truly a limitation in the law. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, has a better opportunity to send somebody to prison for a criminal act than the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That's definitely a problem. And also, you mentioned 4,500 workers dying per year. The numbers have slightly gone down since the economy has crashed, you know, the numbers stay steady. So there's no way that OSHA has been given enough resources to truly combat this problem. You know, nearly 400,000 people have died in the last roughly 30 years. You know, for some reason, it's acceptable to our congressional members, you know, if just under 5,000 are dying per year. It's really sickening.
Well, it's surprising, though, that something as dangerous as ammonium nitrate has so little oversight, because, you know, the bomb that was used in Oklahoma City, which happened on April the 19th, and that, of course, was the reason that McVeigh let it off on April the 19th, was because nearby Waco, where this blast took place at Adair's fertilizer plant, that was also the Waco burning of the Branch Davidians was on April the 19th. So I know that's a little off topic here, but not that it's not in the news because of what's been going on with these bombings. But the point I want to make is that ammonium nitrate is incredibly dangerous, and that's what Tim McVeigh used, ammonium nitrate mixed with diesel. It's called ANFO. It's what, by the way, the Taliban use in these IEDs that kill American troops in Afghanistan. In 1947, 3,200 tons of ammonium nitrate fertilizer detonated aboard a ship in a Texas City port, which killed 600 people. And that apparently is, to this day, the deadliest industrial accident in U.S. history. So somebody didn't get the memo on how dangerous ammonium nitrate is.
Right. It's interesting you bring up the Texas City disaster. You know, that occurred from ships and ports. They had come, I believe, from France over to the United States, and there was no controls in place in 1947. Everything was just hunky-dory. I don't think they really understood the capacity of what an explosion could do. But you would think that they would learn from that point, and our government would step up and put some, you know, strong regulations, some sensible safeguards in place to shield the public from disasters like these. It's not just ammonium nitrate or, you know, anhydrous ammonia or any of these chemicals. These explosions happen frequently in oil refineries. Texas is no stranger to that. BP's had disasters down there. Two or three months ago out your way in Richmond, California, there was a chemical explosion up in the refinery up there. You know, chemicals are very, very serious. You would think that we would have learned our lessons by now, and our elected congressional figures would step up and shield the public from this type of activity, but the regulatory process is extremely slow and stagnant, and our elected officials hardly ever react unless there's a disaster. It's quite shocking.
So tell us, Keith Wrightson, about the U.S. Chemical Safety Board. That's the federal agency overseeing investigation of industrial chemical accidents. And somebody, I can't remember who it was, I interviewed fairly recently. I think it was to do when that huge superstorm hit New Jersey and New York, pointed out how these massive chemical plants in New Jersey are virtually just above sea level, and how the chemical lobby has prevented really meaningful legislation about protecting the public from these incredibly toxic chemicals that could either be spilled because of a hurricane bursting the containers, and that they don't isolate the really dangerous ones from each other. If they ever mix together, it could be unbelievably catastrophic. So apparently the chemical lobby has got a lot of clout, and they're not which has enabled them not to provide sufficient safety, at least in New Jersey and places like that where they concentrate. But what's the story with this oversight agency?
So the Chemical Safety Board, they're not a, from what I understand, a standard-setting agency or a regulatory creator, essentially, right? From what I understand, the Chemical Safety Board actually reacts to accidents and comes in and uncovers them, and they have very limited power. However, they just recently made suggestions in response to an explosion that took place in Hawaii. And the explosion occurred because workers were disassembling fireworks that the United States Customs Organization had seized on a ship coming over from China. They were illegal fireworks. So there was no standards in place to dismantle these fireworks, and they've made a suggestion that, you know, the government should start to regulate this type of activity. So there's another chemical or a powder or a substance, obviously easily ignitable, that there's no regulations around. And apparently the Customs Authority seizes all kinds of explosives when, you know, they pass through ports. There was a tragedy in Hawaii, I believe it was in 2010. And all the, I think it was 12 workers lost their lives in that explosion. But yet, no regulation in place. So it's troubling. Lobbyists have reign over our system. Our government should be for the people and by the people, but you have to have a checkbook, apparently, to get in line down in Congress. So it's very troubling. Our system, you know, essentially it's broken, that's a deep concern for workers and industry.
Well, I just looking here at the Associated Press say that the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration fined this company, West Fertilizer or Adair, $10,000 last summer for safety violations that included planning for transporting ammonia without a security plan. And they found that the plant's ammonia tanks weren't properly labeled, and the government accepted $5,250, about half of the fine. So there we have it. I thank you for joining us, Keith Wrightson. This is extremely disturbing information.
Thanks for having me on, Ian. It's been my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Keith Wrightson, the worker safety and health advocate at Public Citizens Congress Watch Division. He advocates before Congress, state, and federal agencies to improve conditions for workers and for occupational safety and health. We're going to take a brief station break and be back joined by Mark Danner talking about the new report on torture. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, is a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Truth and Torture, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be here.
And the Task Force on Detainee Treatment, as this new study was called by the Constitutional Project, which is a bipartisan group, in a sense, it's what it's warning the nation is to avoid the mistakes of seeking revenge through human rights violation, as was done after 9/11. And that, of course, really gets to the mind, if indeed that's not too kind a description of Dick Cheney and George W. Bush and what they did and how they basically reacted to 9/11. And they really are, that report absolutely eviscerates them. But for what they did, but it also goes after the Obama administration for not doing anything about it.
Yes, no one comes out of the report smelling very well, I would say. Certainly, the Bush administration takes the major brunt of the criticisms, as it should, but the Obama administration coming into office with a chance to investigate some of what went on and to create a clear record of what was done. Given that opportunity, it basically punted and decided, in President Obama's famous words, that the country is better to look forwards rather than backwards. And the report, you know, is extremely useful in all kinds of ways, not least by putting that clearly on the record, but also by stating unequivocally that the nation engaged in torture, giving a very clear statement of why it came to that conclusion in a way I think that is almost impossible to argue with, and also making the general statement that after a very extensive investigation, the task force concluded that none of this torture was necessary, that no information, there's no evidence that information was gained by these techniques that could not have been gained in other ways. And these unequivocal statements, I think, you know, put forward by a bipartisan commission of very highly distinguished people, including a very prominent Republican, former Republican congressman and official, Asa Hutchinson, are extremely valuable. It would be much better, of course, to have a governmental commission, which President Obama has declined to appoint, unfortunately. But short of that, short of a commission that actually acted, you know, with subpoena power and other things, this is likely the best that we're going to get.
Well, Mark Denner, so much of this is involved with secrecy, and it was done through the CIA, and there is a separate 6,000-page report on the Central Intelligence Agency's record, which was done by the Senate Intelligence Committee based on agency records, and that remains classified. Now, the chair of that committee, Dianne Feinstein, at the time of that movie, Zero Dark 30, she went public and criticized the movie and reiterated that torture did not work. But within the agency, there's obviously two different groups, if you will. They're the kind of Cuban Americans who came in during the 60s and the Bay of Pigs disaster, and have there's quite a few of them in the agency. And of course, Rodriguez is one of the major apologists for torture, and for reasons which mystify me, the CIA decided to put all of these Cuban Americans in charge of the Arab countries. None of them spoke Arabic. So, you know, there's a bit of a civil war going on within the agency, I understand, between those who recognize the truth of the matter, that it was a complete catastrophe and a total shame, and those like Rodriguez, who have written books and proudly said that they got it right, and we caught bin Laden because of torture and all that nonsense.
Well, I think you're right that there is what might be called a civil war within the agency. I'm not sure whether it tracks completely along the lines of Cuban Americans and Jose Rodriguez, who I think is of Puerto Rican extraction, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I've just insulted the Cuban Americans. I'm sorry.
Latin American, in any event. But the I think we're talking about very much a division that probably tracks more closely along the lines of people who were part of this program and approved it, part of the so-called enhanced interrogation program, and those who weren't part of it and who thought to varying degrees that it would harm and has harmed the agency to be associated with it and to have agreed to do it, to develop it and to use these techniques. And it's, as the report actually points out, there are very obvious careerist motives when it comes to the position taken by many of these people. I mean, if you have been in part of the program, or if you were a high-level promoter of it, and the most obvious person that fits that description is former Vice President Richard Cheney, then you have much more of an incentive to argue vociferously that this program was absolutely necessary in saving lives. After all, if you push this program and it was useless, it's a lot harder to argue that you were justified in putting this thing forward. And, you know, what's extremely useful, I think, when it comes to this report is it is a full examination of what went on. And it basically concludes, you know what, so far as we can tell, there's no evidence that information was gained using torture that couldn't have been gained in other ways. Now, it may be that the Senate Intelligence Committee report that you mentioned, which is supposed to be about 6,000 pages and hasn't been declassified, will have a much more persuasive argument supporting that claim. We do know publicly by the committee chairman, Dianne Feinstein, and statements from other members of the committee that it comes to the same conclusion, that this stuff was not necessary at all, that it didn't save lives, as Vice President Cheney and others have doggedly argued. But the Senate committee report does have the virtue of being based on classified documents as well. So it's impossible to claim in the face of that, as Cheney and others have repeatedly, that, you know, if you only knew what we knew, you would know that this stuff was absolutely necessary. We can only hope that the Senate Intelligence Committee report is declassified at some time in the near future, because it sounds like next to this report that we just got, this is going to be the absolutely definitive account, but we haven't been able to see it yet, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, and the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. Now, of course, one of the great tragedies, the enduring tragedies of America's torture shame as a result of 9/11 is very evident, for example, in the tit-for-tat that's going on between Russia and the U.S. Over the lists of people that the U.S. is banning involved with the Magnitsky affair. In retaliation, Putin has put up a list that includes America's torturers,
right.
John Yoo and Addington. And I think they wanted to put Dick Cheney on the list, but decided to hold off on that. As you say, Dick Cheney's unapologetic. I'm sure the others are as well. You know, recently, of course, George W. Bush said he has no regrets about the Iraq War. It's obvious that reality has not intruded on any of these people, and on the neocons too, the architects, the intellectual, if that's not too generous a description, the intellectuals behind the Iraq War and this whole exuberant policy of drive-by democracy.
Well, I think that's quite true. I mean, obviously, torture and the subject of this particular report on detainee treatment and is a different, smaller subject than the Iraq War itself. I think you're right, though, that the implication that these two things subjects are very much linked, and that one of the regrettable things that's happened over the last decade is that torture and the so-called enhanced interrogation has become a political issue with a very strong political cast to it. We know in the last months of the campaign, the last presidential campaign last fall, that a memo was leaked from the Romney campaign that essentially supported the reimposition of enhanced interrogation techniques in a possible Romney administration. The idea that essentially using these things as a kind of badge of courage and a demonstration of will in fighting the war on terror. And it is a remarkable thing that, you know, now when it comes to torture of our two main political parties, one of them, at least, the Republican, have a clear position on torture, which is that they're for it. The Democrats seem to be more divided on it, as usual. Some of them are against it. Some of them also are for it. So the politics of interrogation and torture are now completely mixed up with fighting the war on terror, with the Iraq War, with an aggressive policy associated with the neoconservatives. I agree with you on that. And that, you know, is something that I think it would have been very hard to predict. I mean, it seems it would have been inconceivable before September 11th. And it's a very strong indication of how the country has changed, how it changed as a result of actions taken in the wake of those attacks. And again, I think it's one reason why this report by the Constitution Project is so important. You know, I hope it's written in very clear language. It's fascinating in many of its details. And I hope some of your listeners who are interested in this subject will look it up on the Internet. It's very easy to find. And it is going to be the definitive account, I'm afraid, until the Senate Intelligence Committee report is declassified, if and when that happens. But it does. It is a pretty a pretty damning picture of what happened to our country in the wake of September 11th, 2001, and what the condition of that country still is.
Well, I certainly one can't make excuses for the Democrats and their fecklessness and their lack of courage in standing up to a lot of issues, and in particular this one, because it is at the heart of all of the national security issues involved in the post-Cold War, in this world of transnational and subnational threats. You know, we have gone to war against tyrants who have essentially we've gone to war against criminals, you know, like Saddam Hussein, the torturers, like Saddam, like Gaddafi, like Milosevic. Everything that's happened in the post-Cold War and Noriega down in Panama was the first one in the post-Cold War. Every war that the United States has gotten involved in has ostensibly been about some terrible dictator that we feel we have to get rid of. And it has not worked out well. It's resulted in enormous collateral damage. Millions or thousands, hundreds of thousands of innocent people have died as a result. And we're trying, the world body is trying to come up with some kind of regime, short of invading countries through the International Criminal Court, of dealing with these tyrants like Mugabe and like the one that's murdering his own people now, Assad. And the only way that's going to work is if somebody has the moral high ground. And guess what Bush and Cheney did? They completely took the rug out of America's moral high ground. So we've got a lot of backfilling to do.
Yeah, I do agree with that. Although it is, when it comes to policy in the Middle East, for example, it's quite easy to exaggerate the degree to which the U.S. had the moral high ground before September 11th. Indeed, the September 11th attacks were in part an indication of the lack of moral high ground, because part of the root cause of those attacks, of course, and needless to say, I'm not trying to justify them, they were horrible things, but part of the root cause had to do with the U.S. systemic and essential support for dictators in the Middle East, notably the Mubarak regime in Egypt and the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia. And, you know, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri were partly attacking the U.S. in the belief that if you attack the puppet master, possibly the strings to the puppets, that is Mubarak and the Saudi king, might be cut as a result. So I agree with you about the destruction of any moral high ground the U.S. Had. That's certainly the case. And it means that now when the U.S. talks about human rights violations, there is a substantial part of the world that chortles. You know, these things that the United States did as a matter of public policy, approved by its highest officials, including the President of the United States and the Vice President, are a matter of public record. And we live in a very strange netherworld now where you have the current president and the current attorney general say on the record that waterboarding is illegal, and the former president, George W. Bush, and his vice president say proudly that they approved it. They say it in writing in their memoirs. So it's a very odd when it comes
right. Maybe there's not much of a distinction between a country being totally hypocritical and having its friends, its dictator friends, do the torturing for it, and a country that actually does the torturing itself. I mean, that's the line that was crossed. I thank you for joining us, Mark Danner.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Ian. Thank you, and I hope, as I say, that your listeners will have a look at this remarkable report from the Constitution Project. It's well worth a read, and I'm glad you're giving some attention to it. I appreciate that.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who was a longtime writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, and is the author of Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.